We're in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and what we had seen last was a quick overview of the laws of Tzitzit. Now, what comes next in the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch are the laws of Tefillin and the laws of Mezuzah. But being that we have a sofer, Rav Siegel, who gives classes in both of these, as far as I know, so I'm going to skip those. I also understood that he gave classes in Tzitzit. So instead of taking 2 weeks, a week for Tefillin and a week for Mezuzah, I'm going to skip that and assume that you all hear it by Rav Siegel.
And Rav Lisman also gives Shiur on Tzitzit.
Okay, fine. So I'm skipping those. Ordinarily, we go in order of the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, so whoever wants to follow with the English, we're holding chapter 12. Now, assuming that everyone knows that in the morning you have to put on Tzitzit and we get ready for prayer, we wear tefillin for prayer, and the laws of tefillin, hopefully everyone's learned. So now we're up to the preparation of one's body and where one will pray. So the Torah tells us, prepare towards your God, O Israel. And our sages derived from that, wasn't mean to prepare, it means that one should be dressed in a respectable fashion when he's coming to pray. And what's considered a respectable fashion? That depends on where you live. If you live in Arab countries where people walk around barefoot, so fine, you could come to prayer barefoot. If you live in places where what's respectable is to wear sandals, then you could come with sandals. If you live in the United States where what's respectable is to wear shoes with socks, and usually you won't do anything respectable with just sandals, then chances are that the right thing is to show up to prayer with shoes with socks. This is a social norm. We say you have to treat prayer in the way that you would treat meeting with an important person, the way that the average person would treat meeting with an important person. And this applies to wherever you're going to pray. Even if you're praying at home, person should be standing, he's going to speak to his Creator. Wherever he's praying, he should be standing in a respectable fashion. The minimum is to wear a shirt, to wear pants. I mean, that's the minimum. A person can't, shouldn't be praying in just underwear. But what a person should do is a person should be dressed the way he feels is respectable, the way society has accepted is respectable.
How do you determine that? If we're based on,
depending on where you are. If you're in Israel, so in Israel things have been changing. There was a time where people would show up to the Knesset in shorts and sandals. So then if a person would say, well, I would show up to the Knesset in shorts and sandals, so he could also legitimize praying in shorts and sandals. Today, I don't think that, no, it's a social norm. It's not just what you're comfortable with. Today, I don't think anyone would show up to the Knesset in shorts and sandals. The world has changed. So today, I don't think a person should really stand in prayer in shorts and sandals. It's not the end of the world, but ideally, we're trying to show respect in the prayer. So a person should try and pray dressed respectably. When I was in the United States, so before I went to pray, I put on a tie. Here in Israel, I only put on a tie when I'm sitting on a video camera in front of the American audience. Because in the American audience's mind, if you're a rabbi, you have to wear a tie. But Israelis know that here in Israel, rabbis don't wear a tie. So I don't wear a tie to go to prayer, because that's not what's the social norm. I don't wear a tie. Sometimes I go to weddings without a tie. unless I'm going to guys at the Machon who are from the United States or Europe, and I know their relatives are going to say he's a rabbi without a tie. So fine, out of respect to them, I put on a tie. So the social norm here in Israel is that you don't have to wear a tie. People do show up to the Knesset without a tie. So then I don't wear a tie. But there are other things. The social norm is that you do show up to a wedding with certain kinds of clothing. So a person should try to dress that way. It's nice if a person has a special garment that he puts on in honor of prayer. It could be a jacket, could be a tie, could be a shirt. I have friends who switch shirts just before prayer. They have a shirt that they hop into the bathroom, put on a button-down shirt. It's nice. A person should try to prepare himself for prayer. It's a nice thing a person should give tzedakah before prayer. The pasuk says, "Ani b'tzedek achazef anecha." I come to see your face, God, out of righteousness, so to speak, out of tzedek, and the tzedek is tzedakah. Now, a person doesn't have to give a lot of money. You could give 25 cents. You could give a nickel, a dime. Doesn't matter. But it shows before I meet you, God, I'm first. I care for someone else. I give tzedakah, and I come to see you. The Kabbalists say that a good time to do it in the morning prayer is by Vayivarech David. That's when the Sfardim do it. If you want to, just mention as an adjunct, if one's wife is pregnant, then it's a good custom to take three identical coins, meaning you could take three 10 agurot pieces, which end up 30 agurot, which is under 10 cents. Three identical coins and give them to tzedakah, and when one gives them to tzedakah, to pray for the fetus. You could give 3 pennies. Yeah, you give 3 pennies. Before one begins prayer, so one should recognize that our prayer is for the Jewish people. It's not only for myself. You'll notice that Shmona Esrei, almost every part of Shmona Esrei is in plural sense. Refa'einu, heal us. Slach lanu, forgive us. That's why on Yom Kippur, for example, we say, forgive us, God, for we have sinned with idol worship. Well, I didn't serve idols. So why am I saying forgive us for idol worship? Because I'm not only praying for myself. Yeah?
So you mentioned a couple days ago that actually you're not even supposed to pray for yourself. When you ask for something, it's because it will benefit either Hashem or it will benefit society in some way. That when you pray for
I don't know what you mean.
It's in... Did you know what you're talking about this?
I hear, so ask him. I don't know.
I know what you're talking
about. I don't know what he meant by that.
Who wrote the misnagged version of Balav?
Nefesh HaChaim? HaChaim
Balazs? That's where it is.
So that's a deep concept that I'm going to leave for him to expand on. We have a class on it. We discussed that in this world, every action has a ripple effect. And the whole world is like one big puddle, where when you drop a stone in the middle, you have the immediate bubbles around it, you have the immediate waves that the stone forms. Then as it goes out through the puddle, they get wider and wider and less and less strong. We discussed that every action will affect many people, not only oneself, and this applies to prayer as well. And the person should view his actions in that light. But this is something which deserves its own class. In general, we're going to go with the simple understanding where we're praying for ourselves as one of the Jewish people. And therefore, before we pray, we should have that in mind. That v'avtal racha kamocha. It's a good thing before a person starts praying to think, I accept on myself the mitzvah to love my fellow Jew. And I'm standing here on behalf of the Jewish people. Now, we know that when a group of 10 people stand together in prayer, we call that a minyan. So then God says, when I look at them, I say, that group has this merit and that merit. I gather together their merits, but I don't gather together their faults. I let their faults fall by the wayside. Meaning, logically, you'd say, God could do the same thing about our faults. Say, there's one guy in that group who did this, and there's another guy in that group who did that. Why should I listen to their prayer? But God says, no, I work the other way around. With the Jewish people, you have a grouping together, they stand together in prayer. So I take the merits, and each one's merits will act on behalf of the others. And our sages stress that it's important to try and pray with a minyan. So, being that part of the concept of minyan is that we're all getting together, so a person before he starts praying should think, he accepts the mitzvah to love his fellow Jew, and he will, together with them, stand in prayer.
Question.
Sure.
Where does the concept of the minyan come from?
The pasuk says, Elokim nitzav adat kel, that God, so to speak, is standing in watch the second there's a grouping of people. Adat kel. The word eida in Hebrew, our sages derived, means 10. 10 Jews is an eida. Mm-hmm. And therefore we say, kol davar shebekdusha, anything that will have holiness should have a minimum of 10 Jews there. Kaddish, you need 10 Jews. And same thing, chazar sashatz. So one should try to pray in a minyan, and one should try to pray in a shul. Let's say one is traveling, and he comes to an area where he'd like to rest. And he's traveling, let's say, from New York to Canada. So he's traveling north. He reaches Buffalo, and he wants to stop. But he knows that if he continues traveling the direction that he wants to go for another 72 minutes, there'll be a minyan there. And if he reverses, if he goes back 18 minutes drive, he'll catch a minyan there. So we say that's the measurement. that one has to, that's the amount of effort one should put to get the minyan. Either 72 minutes journey in the direction you would have wanted to go, but you would have rather spend the night here, and instead you'll continue traveling another 72 minutes in that direction, or 18 minutes back, which is really 18 minutes back, and then you'll have to travel those 18 minutes again. That's really 36 minutes. So we say that's the measurement of how much toil one has to put in for minyan. So you guys, whenever you're calculating, do I have to go to minyan or not, that's how you factor it. I remember after my wife gave birth to our firstborn, so after a long day in the hospital, I came home at night, and I was wiped. It was a long day. I mean, labor started at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd been on my feet all day. 10 o'clock at night, I didn't want to go to minyan. But as I was getting off the bus, I said to myself, okay, am I that wiped? Is it 18 minutes back? Is it 72 minutes forward? I said, no. It's definitely going to be less effort than to travel another 72 minutes when I'm tired at the end of the day's journey. So I forced myself to go down in minyan that night. The minyan was a 5-minute walk from my house, but you know, till you get to the minyan, till they start downing, till you get back, it is difficult. That's how you have to calculate. When a person is in a situation where the minyan is going to be difficult, so you say the amount of difficulty you have to put in is that amount of toil. That's how much a person has to struggle to get the minyan.
Suppose you're not sitting right, it's like if you're in a car and you're going to sit in your car, okay, 72 minutes forward, I'll sit in the car. But what if the hotel is in one place and then the minyan is how far ahead of you, how far back?
So factor the same amount of toil, meaning assuming that
at that point, if you're sleeping at one point over the night, any direction toward Canada or back toward New York is out of the way.
It's 18 minutes, right? So then you factor 18 minutes worth of toil.
Yeah, not 72,
right? Because it's out of your way.
Yeah.
So, right. It's not a factor of 18 minutes journey. It's a factor of that much toil. Sometimes you say, look, I don't care. I'll go there. I'll pick up supper over there. It's on the way. It's good for me. So then even if it takes a half hour. Sometimes a person has to tell himself, you know, if I'm going to do this factoring every day, then I won't go to minyan at all. And that's not good either. People should try not to put themselves in a situation where they don't go to minyan. Person has to take a business trip and he's going to travel to a place where there's no minyan. He could take that business trip. That's not the issue. But if a person's going to spend his whole life traveling and he's never going to end up in minyan, it's going to affect how he is religiously. So then there's the general picture. A person should be smart and think about it. Hey, I want to be a part of the Jewish people. I want my prayers to be accepted too. I need God's help. Why should I always be praying alone? When a person stands alone in prayer, he has much less of a chance that his prayers will be accepted. God says, okay, you're coming here on your own. Let's see, are you worth accepting your prayers or not? When you stand together with a group, you stand together with a minyan. And God says, does this group deserve it? And then each one's merits helps one another. And the detractions, they all fall by the wayside. So it's in a person's best interest to daven with a minyan. And for those of you who are in Chutz La'aretz, it's even more important, because in Chutz La'aretz, what's kept the Jewish communities is the community, the kehillah. So a person who says, I won't daven in shul, he's hurting himself in a much larger way. Not just the question of whether this prayer will be accepted. A person has to be part of a kehillah. It's one of the ways that you ensure that you and your children will continue being religious. It's so important to arrange a minyan that, let's say you live in a yeshuv and you have 10 men. So each one says, I got to get to work at this time, I got to get to work at that time, I don't want to wake up at 6:30, I don't want to wake up at 6, I don't want a minyan that's so fast, I don't want a minyan that's so slow. So it's very easy to run into a situation where there's no minyan in the yeshuv. So the halacha says that the members of the community can enforce a tax. That if you don't show up to minyan, then you have to pay a tax, X amount of dollars, X amount of shekel. Because it's important that in each community you have a minyan. The Gemara says if a person doesn't show up to shul, if he lives in a community and he says, I won't show up to shul. So then he's called a shechen ha, he's called a bad neighbor. God doesn't like such a person. How can you be in a community and not show up to the shul? So a person could have 100 excuses. A person is ER, he's an emergency room doctor. He's always on the run. Yeah, fine. A person will sometimes have scenarios in his life where for a year at a time he could say he has a reason not to show up to shul. Now, I had that times in my life that sometimes a person is busy with something that's life-threatening. Let's say, God forbid, a person has a relative he has to take care of. Sometimes you have to be by that bedside 24/7. You barely get time to go shower. There are times like that in life. And even at times like that, a person should try to factor in that one of the important things that he's going to get a break from the bedside is to go pray in a minyan. In general, it's something people should keep in mind. People shouldn't only be thinking, well, am I obligated now? Right, sometimes you're not obligated. Sometimes that's the situation. But even when you're not obligated, for your own sake, you have to be a part of the minyan. When we go to pray, so the verse states, watch your feet as you go to the house of worship of Hashem. And our sages taught us that the Torah always speaks in a clean fashion. When the Torah, when the Navi, the prophet said, watch your feet, the Navi was alluding to something else. And that is that when one is in prayer, one has to have a clean body. One cannot be standing in prayer and pass air. If one has passed air, he may not continue praying. He himself. The truth is, anyone else that smells it also may not continue praying. And one should also cleanse his body before he goes to pray. A person is supposed to go to the bathroom before he goes to pray. If a person can go to the bathroom, even if he doesn't have to, he shouldn't pray. Even if it'll be at the expense of davening with the minyan. Meaning if the minyan is starting right now, and a person feels like he could go to the bathroom, so he should go to the bathroom, even if that's going to mean that he will miss the minyan. Because if one stands to pray when his body isn't clean, when really he could go to the bathroom, so then that's not a good prayer. God says, I want you to be standing before me with a clean body. It's also a nice thing. Yeah?
That's three times a day. I mean, that's hard to go to the bathroom.
Right? You don't have to. If you don't have to, you don't have to. But if you could, you should. That's why I like ending class 5 minutes before prayer. Guys always push me and say, we have another 5 minutes to prayer. And I always feel bad, because what if someone has to relieve themselves? Then they're going to do that at the expense of minyan. Or people don't know the salaha, they're going to pray, and they're not praying properly. It's not right. A person is supposed to be fully focused on prayer. They're supposed to go to the bathroom beforehand. Let's say a person prayed, and afterwards he runs out to the bathroom. That always gets me. You always see, right after Shemona Esrei, there's a line to the bathroom. So all those people, how could they pray? If they had to go to the bathroom, they should have gone beforehand. So some people, they really didn't have to go. But the rule is, if you could wait 72 minutes, then you don't have to repeat that prayer. Meaning, if you didn't have to go that badly, then it's not that bad that you have to repeat the prayer. Still, we would recommend the right thing is to go to the bathroom and then pray. But if a person could have held himself in for another 72 minutes, then we say he doesn't have to repeat the prayer. If he had to go that badly that he couldn't wait 72 minutes, then he has to repeat that prayer. And the prayer wasn't accepted. So Ari, you want to ask something? There's nothing you could do. Nothing you could do.
So which one do you do?
Then you finish praying and then you go. When we learned this Gemara by Rabbi Feinstein, so I remember he told us, sometimes, he said, sometimes you could be standing before prayer and you feel like, I don't have to go. And then you're in the middle of Shemona Esrei and suddenly you realize you do, so what can you do? And then to quote him, still remember this line, he said, and sometimes before Shemona Esrei you run and you realize, hey, it's a false alarm. That was his line. So what can you do? But you have to prepare yourself. What? I don't think so. Yeah.
In Yom Kippur, it happened that one of the guys praying before me in the middle of Shemona Esrei, and they're suddenly thrown up. In this situation.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that. we have to discuss a few things before that. We'll get there. I don't think we'll get there today, but we'll get to that. Let's say a person had a very good Shulam Shabbos, and he shows up Shabbos morning to Shul, and he realizes he's not going to make it between Kriya Shema and Shemona Esrei. He's not going to be able to do it and keep his body clean without passing air. So then he shouldn't pray. One may not pray and pass air. If one can contain himself for that short juncture of Shema and Shemona Esrei, so then he should say that. And he should put on tefillin right before Shema and take them off right after Shemona Esrei. One may not pass air when he's wearing tefillin, nor when he is in prayer. If one sees he won't be able to contain himself, then he shouldn't pray. Then that day he cannot. He can't. We have to wash our hands before prayer. And we have to wash our hands till the joint. So which joint is that? So there are two opinions. One opinion says till the knuckle. One opinion says till the wrist. two different joints. So usually we go with the more stringent opinion. All year long we wash our hands to the wrist. On Yom Kippur, we wash our hands to the knuckle, because that's really the basic opinion. Till the knuckles. You wash your hands till the knuckles. On Yom Kippur, well, you're washing your whole hand till the knuckle. You're washing all the fingers till the knuckle. So how do you do that? The knuckles aren't aligned. So you pour the water and you stick your fingers into the water as it's pouring. That's how you get, because if you're going to pour till the knuckle on the thumb, it goes way beyond the other knuckles on the rest of the hand, right? The thumb knuckle is far higher up. So how do you get every finger till the knuckle? You pour the water and stick your finger, you pass your hand in through the stream of water as you're pouring. Now, ideally, one should wash his hands with the vessel before each prayer. If one cannot do that, let's say there's no water available, then one may wipe his hands clean. But that's a bidyevet, that's not lechatchila. The proper way is before prayer, one should wash his hands, which is another thing that I don't see people doing. People say, let's end class a minute before prayer. There's no way that everyone's going to be able to wash their hands and get to prayer if we're ending right with enough time for people to run up to prayer. I'm just explaining to you guys why I always try to end 5 minutes before prayer. It's not that I'm trying to cut class. I want everyone to have a chance to relieve themselves and wash their hands, because that's the halacha. A person is supposed to do both before prayer.
Washing hands before every prayer?
Yeah, halachically you have to wash your hands before every prayer, yeah. Even if you don't know that your hands are dirty. Let's say you wash your hands in the morning. But we say, without your noticing, you scratched your head, your hands touched things. You scratched your ear. Your hands aren't so clean. So you're going to go pray. Your hands should be clean for prayer. Yeah.
I thought if you didn't do any of those things from the list you gave us before, and you've washed your hands before, and in the meantime, then you don't have to wash your hands.
No, we say that usually the hands are busy. Usually, unless you focused and said, now I will wash, I will watch my hands to ensure that they remain clean, we assume that you didn't wash them well enough.
And what if you've wiped your hands like right after you scratch your head? You still have to go wash your hands?
The proper thing is before every prayer to wash one's hands. Regardless what happens, the right thing is that before every prayer, one should wash his hands. That's part of the preparation for prayer. Now, another thing
before
you guys...
Before every davening.
Not before every bracha. Yeah?
Does the netilat yadayim and the... washing after going to the bathroom in the morning, does that count as preparation for the prayer as well? Or should we wash like a third time before we pray?
That depends on how much time passed. Let's say a person wakes up in the morning, he washes his hands, goes to the bathroom, washes his hands again. Now, depends what happens. If he's going to put on his shoes, for example, so his hands got dirty again. Let's say a person got all dressed, and then went to the bathroom, and then washed his hands, and then went straight to the shul to daven. So then he could say, here in the machon, you walk down the hallway from your room to the shul. So a person could say, I washed my hands a minute ago and I walked out of the bathroom. That's my washing for the prayer. But let's say a person lives far away from shul, and he's going to go to the bathroom, wash his hands at home, then put on his gloves, put on his coat, drive to shul, come out and go into shul, then he should probably wash his hands again. It depends on what the distance between the home and the shul is. You should know that the proper custom, when one is in a Jewish area, like here in Israel, the proper thing is to wear your talis and tefillin at home and walk with them to shul. Meaning, prepare your body, prepare, wash your hands and everything at home, and then put on your talis and tefillin and walk into shul with your talis and tefillin on. That's why a person should go to shul. If you live in chutzlar, it's unfortunately, if you live where there are non-Jews around, so then you shouldn't do that. You don't do things that are going to look strange and jut out to the non-Jews. That you're not supposed to do. But if you're living, let's say, in a community like Muncie, or living in a community where you hardly see a non-Jew, on Shabbos you don't see a car running by, without roadblocks. But bottom line, there aren't any non-Jews around. It's a Jewish community where there are only Jews, or 99.999% Jews. So then you could. There are opinions that say you could, there are opinions that say you can't. Those that say you could say, well, what's the problem? This is your community. And those that say you can't say, if you'll do it here, then everyone will see you doing it. They'll start doing it in other areas. Your children will do it in other areas. And they'll end up doing it in locations where it'll cause anti-Semitism. So we go by the country. That's why some people say, they say that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say, Rav Pesen Zatzal used to quote Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, that he said, even on Shabbos, people who live in an area where there's no Erev, they should leave their talis in shul, but they should not wear their talis from their home to the shul and from the shul to the home. Because even if you live in a community where that won't cause anti-Semitism, but there are other communities where it will cause anti-Semitism. So we don't go only by this community. We say if this action in this country will cause anti-Semitism, even though in your specific location it will not, we say you should not do that. Yeah?
I'm asking a completely simple thing. Do you have to wash three times when you're washing before davening?
No. No.
Okay. And any of the times when you like scratch your head, you have to wash three times?
I don't remember. I think I told you I'd look it up. I think so. Okay, so I owe you that. Okay. A person should ideally pray with the congregation. Let's say a person is sick. He can't leave the house. And this is another thing. Rav Pesach Zatzal used to tell us that if we're sick, we shouldn't come to shul, because we have no right to get other people sick. And if a person is contagious, so people sometimes say, I'll go to shul. So a person might be erring on two fronts. On one front, we say, if you're sick, so your body needs to rest. Take care of yourself. That's your obligation. And on the second front is, who allows you to go to shul and cough over old people whose immune system is down and give them whatever illness you have? So if a person isn't feeling well, we're not talking about a common cold. If a person has the common cold, so still he should maintain a distance from other people. He could daven in a place where he won't be coughing on people. But we're talking about something more serious. A person has fever, a person has a serious cough. So then a person should stay away from people. If he can figure out a way of getting to shul, and sometimes you have a huge shul and you could stand on one end and you're not near anyone else. So then the only question is, will it harm a person's health? So a person has to factor in. Does he have to spend the day in bed? So then he'll get out of bed just to put on tefillin and daven, and then get back into bed. But even then, even in a situation where a person is not davening with the congregation, we say that the time when they daven is the time that he should daven. And then, so to speak, their prayers get together and they'll go up together. The good time to daven, God says, David HaMelech said, I pray to God at a time that's a favorable time. When is considered a favorable time? When the congregation is praying. So you live here in Kiryat Moshe, it's pretty easy. There's a minyan at 6 o'clock, there's a minyan at 6:15, there's a minyan at 6:30, there's a minyan at 6:45, there's a minyan at 7. You have minyanim running all the time. So here it's easy. But if you live in Vancouver or Oregon, you might have only one minyan. You live in some yeshuv, there might be only one minyan during the day. So then, if a person can, a person should try to align his Shmona Esrei, that his Shmona Esrei should be at the same time that the congregation is praying. Let's say a person can't make either one. Person's traveling and he stops in. He thought that they're praying at this congregation, that there's an 8 o'clock minyan. He shows up, they tell him the last minyan was 7 o'clock. So then we say, better pray in a shul or in a bit midrash than pray anywhere else. Meaning, if a person cannot make the time of prayer that the congregation prays, and a person cannot make the congregation itself, meaning he can't make it to minyan, so then at least he should daven in a shul or in a bet midrash. Those are holy places, and even if, let's say, a person shows up to shul and they don't make a minyan, you have only six people there. So some guys say, okay, I'll go to work, I'll daven there. It's not right. You're already in shul, daven in shul. There's a mitzvah to daven even alone in a shul rather than anywhere else. A person should also try to daven in a set place. A set place doesn't mean you have to stand in this specific box. It means within 4 footsteps. That's all considered the same place. And the person should try to pray where he learns. It's worth a lot. It's, according to some opinions, we don't go that way, but some opinions say that's more important than praying with a minyan. But, let's say a person learns in a Beis Medrash where there's no minyan, and he could go to a minyan. So we say he should go to a minyan and pray there. But there is an opinion that says it's so valuable to pray where you learn that overrides the minyan. We don't go that way, la'alacha. But if a person, like here at Machon Meir, he has a set place in the Beit Midrash where he learns, so you should try to make that the place where he daven.
Can you kick some dabbers in your seat?
Just a second. Daniel's waiting. Yeah.
That's a good question, by the way. Well, I wanted to ask, even if you don't, you're normal, you're working all the day, but you're daven, you want to daven with a minyan, and you have the possibility to go to a normal shul with minyan, or you have the possibility to go to the Beit HaMidrash with Minyan. Which is no should you choose? Should you should go to the Beit HaMidrash or to the normal shul?
If you go to the Beit HaMidrash, will you be able to learn more? There are a lot of practical factors. Meaning, it depends on. I would say each person should ask. Depends. I would answer that question more based upon what will help a person grow.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, there is a question of which is holier. That's a different question. But I don't think that should be the guiding rule here. Meaning, our sages taught us that when a person finishes work in the evening, he should go to shul and learn a little bit and then daven, and that this way his whole house will look different. And this is true in general. You come to shul, so it's not right that people show up. Minyan starts at 6:30, they show up at 6:32. A person should show up at 6:15. When a person comes to daven, a person is supposed to show up before minyan to prepare himself, to sit down and get used to the place, calm down, sit down, put on his talis and tefillin calmly. Try it. Anyone that's tried it knows how beautiful it is. To show up to minyan 15 minutes early, put on your talis and tefillin, learn a mishnah, learn a little bit of the parsha, and then start praying. That's the way a person is supposed to enter prayer. You're supposed to enter prayer after you've done a mitzvah, after you've learned a little bit, you've done something that makes you happy, a holy happiness. Not that you've had a good piece of cake. You enter prayer out of a spiritual happiness. And this could be giving tzedakah, helping someone, but the ideal is that it should be learning something. When the minyan says 6:30, a person should make a mental note, I have to be there at 6:15. Now, usually 6:15 isn't enough, because 6:15 means that's the time you're going to go to the bathroom maybe. If you go to the bathroom at home, so then at 6:15 you'll show up, you put on your towels, your phone, you could learn a little bit and then down. I always marvel, if I show up to 6:30 minyan, so there's a rabbi who shows up at 6:40, and he's showing up for the 7:15 minyan. So he shows up earlier than some of the congregants who show up for the 6:30 minyan. He's showing up at 6:40 to start preparing for the 7:15 minyan. So that's beautiful. Anyone that tries it knows how beautiful it is, and that's the way it should be. Yeah, Ari. Sorry, yeah.
Another question.
No, that's why I'm sorry. Going back to your original question, that's why the question about davening in Beit Midrash or a shul,
mm-hmm.
I don't think is as relevant. What interests me more is where are you going to have a shir? Where are you going to have a rabbi that you can connect to? Where are you going to feel comfortable learning? Where do you have maybe the art scroll Gemara that you like learning from? Maybe which one is closer to your house so that you'll feel comfortable spending a little bit more time learning there.
Mm-hmm.
You won't have to think what traffic to have to compete with to get home. Meaning, I'm looking at the more practical question. I'm saying, what's going to allow you to learn more? Which congregation will you connect to more? Those questions interest me more, halachically, than the question of which is holier. That's why I don't think this question is as relevant. I don't think you should start being focused on which is holier, the shul or the Beit Midrash. It is halacha, but I don't think that's relevant. What's relevant is more what's going to help you grow. And that's what you have to check out.
Another question is that, for example, I mean, in Israel it's not very difficult to find a shul and a minyan. But for example, when I visit my parents, there isn't a Jewish community, there isn't a minyan, there are a few Jews on that day. So, but we have still the synagogue building. It doesn't belong anymore to Jews, but the building still stands, and you can see still that it used to be a synagogue, and it is basically not really used. So would that be, even if there is no Sefer Torah, there is no menorah, there is nothing inside except of the walls of the building which remembers the synagogue, should we pray there or at home?
I'm not sure. I think that in a scenario where the shul is still available to be used as a shul, then it would make sense to continue praying in that shul, even though right now you don't have a minyan and there's no Sefer Torah there, being that you don't have any other shul to go to, you have nowhere else to go, and you don't have a minyan of Jews in that city, so, and you do have this shul that used to belong to Jews, so then I think it would make sense that the Jews should, whatever Jews do remain in the city, being that this building that used to be the only shul that was there, now there's no shul there, those Jews should try and gather in that place and pray at a set time. I do think so. And the reasoning for it goes to many other reasonings, not just the question of the shul. And there are other halachic reasons, which we won't go into now, why I think that's so. But I would have to analyze it a little bit more. Before, if you're going to rely on what I'm telling you to do it practically, and I assume it involves a certain amount of effort, so then I'd want to research it a little bit more before we put in that effort. Yeah, Ari?
What extent can you kick somebody out of your mahkum?
So, that depends. If you have a set place, and this has been your place for years, this is where you daven, so it is okay to tell someone that this is your place, but of course to do it in a nice way. There are shuls that I won't daven in, and the reason is because I show up to shul, I'm there 10 minutes before prayer, and all these places are available. So I find myself a nice place, and I sit down and I start davening. Time for davening comes, and the guy shows up and tells me, this is my seat. So I say, okay, fine, he's entitled to tell me that's a seat. So I move over. 10 minutes later, a guy comes in and tells me, this is my seat. So I move again. 10 minutes later, the same thing happens. Now, we're already a half hour into prayer, and I'm in my fourth seat. A guy who shows up a half hour late comes and tells me, this is my seat. At that point, I walked out of shul and I never walked back to that shul. Why? Because I don't mind that a person tells me this is his seat. He's entitled to have that seat. That's the halacha. Halacha is that you can acquire a seat, you can have a chazak on a seat, you can have a set place to sit. But if you have five people in one shul and no one has the decency to tell a guest, this is my seat, but let me find you a different seat, let me tell you where you could sit, and when I ask them, where can I sit? I don't know. Their sole concern is, this is my seat, don't sit here. I don't want to daven with these people. That's the only shul I won't daven in. I don't mind that. I can understand. You have a shul here. Oh, Yitzchak, people have set seats. But you'll notice that whenever they ask you, they tell you, this is my set seat, they'll show you where there's an available seat. That's the way a person has to behave. But you can't have a situation where you're telling someone, this is my seat, and therefore you kick the person out. And we'll end with a sad story. I was once... We were in shul for a bar mitzvah of a friend of ours, and his father was an optometrist, and he had a worker, the guy who fashioned the glasses. I don't know what that's called. Like, his father was the eye doctor, and this guy used to make the glasses.
The optician
shows up to shul, and we're all davening, and he holds the sitter upside down. So one of the kids looks at him laughing and he says, ha, you got it upside down. So he turns all red and he turns it right side up. And then he turns to my brother and he tells him, you know, when I was a kid, I used to love shul. I used to love religion. And my parents weren't religious. But I came to shul and I was very close to the shul. I loved the shul. I'd come and I'd daven. And then came Yom Kippur, the high holiday. And I came to shul all excited. This is the high holiday. I'm going to have a chance to pray on the high holiday in shul. And I sat down, and prayer began, and a man walked over to me and said, this is my seat. And then he led me to the back to a chart, which showed all the seats that people had purchased. He said, you see, you pay for a seat. This is your seat. And I saw that I had no seat in the shul. And when I saw that, as much as I wanted to pray, because I hadn't paid in advance, I didn't have a seat in the shul, I walked out. And this is the first time I walked back in. So here's a person that wanted to pray, that had actively prayed, but when he was told that that seat wasn't available and that because seats are sold, so he didn't know, he didn't purchase a seat, he didn't feel like he had a place in the shul. He never prayed again. He didn't know how to hold the sitter the right side up. He was holding the sitter upside down. He didn't know. So, yeah, we're supposed to pray in our set place, and we are supposed to have a set place for prayer, and we are entitled to tell the person that's in our place that this is our place, but there's a way to do it. And the way to do it is to ensure that that person has a place and to ensure him that he feels welcome. The Yekish community in Washington Heights, so Yekis, they all have a set seat. And don't you dare take a Yekki seat. I'm a Yekki too. I come from Germanic descent. My grandfather's German. The name Frankenthal is German. So the Yekkish community in Washington Heights, they notice that guests come and they don't know where to sit. So they want guests to come, but they don't want them to take their seats. So what they do is, they have a guy, it's his job, he stands at the entrance to shul, and for the first half hour of prayer, he's standing there. Whoever walks in that's not a congregant, he gives him a talis, a siddur, and he shows him where he can sit. So this way they ensure that everyone gets their seat. No one ends up taking someone else's seat. And the guests also don't feel like they don't get thrown around. Now you should also be smart. When you're a guest in a shul, so ask, where's there an available seat? Don't just sit down. Ask the people, where's their seat, that I won't be taking someone's seat. So yes, a person is entitled and should try to maintain his own seat, but not at the expense of hurting someone's feelings. And let's say a person comes on Yom Kippur or at a time where the shul is full, and he knows that by kicking someone else out of his seat, that other person might not have a seat, then I think the right thing is that a person should forgo his set place and figure himself out where he'll sit, rather than kicking someone else out and leaving that person standing and stranded. You never know the price it'll cost. Yeah.
In a shul, I definitely know the state as in the state of my family. They had a name on all the seats, and I'd said a message, I got up for a second to leave, or a shot, I got back, so I was beside it. I didn't want to bother them because there were no other open seats. So I bought a seat from another room. I had a second place.
Yeah, you also have to remember, it's your home territory. When you come and you don't find the seat...
Well, my name was on
the seat. Yeah, but when you come and you don't find the seat, you will be able to find another seat. Yeah. Because this is your shul, this is where you daven, and you'll know how to get a chair or something. So someone else, it's very uncomfortable, they don't know how to get a seat. So that's also something to factor in. Yeah?
Sometimes I really want to sit in my seat. Go up to I take my seat to her. It's like to show this to myself. Oh, is this you? No, you take it. It's okay. Let me get a bit.